Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you as always for being here. We have got a busy show for you today. Coming up in a couple of moments' time, we've got an interview with the director, one of the directors of a brand new film called Arsene Wenger Invincible. No spoilers, but I think you can probably guess what that one is about. After that, we'll be talking to Phil Costa, some Arsenal chat, football chat, and all the rest. And we are heading into an interlull. One more weekend of Premier League action before we get a two-week break, and many of our players will be going away on international duty, after which we play Liverpool. So it's all a bit scary, but we do have a good chance to get three more points under our belt with a home game on Sunday against Watford. I have to say, I'm finding these European weeks a little bit strange. Not simply for the fact that we're not in Europe, which is part of it, obviously a big part of it. It makes everything really, really quiet, but our lack of involvement in Europe has kind of made me not as interested in Europe in general, which is really weird. I mean, we haven't been in the Champions League for a few years now, and I'd still watch some of those games. But this season, I don't know what it is, whether it's the quiet midweeks, whether there's nothing going on, whether focus is elsewhere or whatever it might be. But Arsenal's lack of involvement in Europe, how do I describe it? It's sort of like when there's a party on that you really want to go to, but you don't get invited, so you just pretend the party's not on. You pay no attention to its existence whatsoever, even though the party's kind of next door and you can hear the music. And what, I don't know if I'm explaining this right. I don't even know what it is. Maybe it's just the fact that we don't have any midweek action, and that's an unusual thing to get used to as an Arsenal fan. The cycle of games, it feels long. Because it is long. It's often 7 days between games. So I'm hoping that this time next year we'll be talking about an Arsenal side that are back in Europe to some degree or another. The fact that we're just 3 points off the top four after four games, I mean, that really should set the standard, set the bar for what remains of this season. I know we've talked and we've had discussions about what would constitute a good season for Arsenal, what would be a successful season for Arsenal. And I think most people would have said getting back into Europe, finishing in the top six, at the very least, would be a successful season for Arsenal if you're looking for us to make progress. That doesn't mean that should be the be-all and end-all and all the rest of it, but based on what's happened the last couple of years, if you're looking to make progress, get back into Europe, top six, top four would be amazing, blah, blah, blah. But I think we had doubts after those opening three games of the season. Now, here we are a little while down the road, and I don't think it's unrealistic at all to think that we should be well and truly in the mix for the top six. And given the way some of the other teams involved are going, why not for the top four? I don't think we'll get there, to be honest. But if you're just 3 points off, why can't you try and keep pace? If West Ham can do it, why can't Arsenal do it? And that's not to be dismissive of West Ham or anything like that, but if people are talking realistically about West Ham being top six, top four contenders, why not Arsenal? They've obviously done very well in recent times, but at the end of it, we only finished 4 points behind them last season. Nobody really would have expected David Moyes to be the manager to take West Ham into the Europa League or even be challenging for the Champions League places. So I think if that's the benchmark, and we've been more or less keeping pace with them when it comes to points, etc., etc. Look, I'm just saying, we've got ourselves into a good position. We're going to fluctuate a little bit, but I think this is more or less the ballpark that we should be in if we're going to consider this season any kind of a success. So let's hope we keep it up at the weekend. We'll talk more about that a bit later on with Phil Costa. But as I said, there is a new film coming out next week. It's called Arsene Wenger Invincible. It's a really interesting look at our former manager, his biggest achievement, not just from the perspective that we might have on it as Arsenal fans who enjoyed that success, etc., etc. Lots of really interesting behind-the-scenes footage from his arrival at the club to his departure in 2018. It's a really, really good watch. It's a story we all know, but it's told in a way which I think will resonate with pretty much every Arsenal fan. So to talk to me about it, I'm delighted to welcome one of the directors of the film, Gabriel Clark. Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Nice to be here.
Tell me this. As a filmmaker, what was it about this story that drove this project? Because as Arsenal fans, it's something many of us lived through and enjoyed and kind of look back on with very rose-tinted glasses because we'd like a bit more of it. But from the outside, what was it about this story that really drew you in and helped bring this project to light?
Well, the was Arsene Wenger himself doing his first film documentary and telling his story. That was the attraction. It's something that's not been done before. Arsene had a book out last year, as you know, and we were able to see that just before we started filming. And I was always fascinated with Arsene Wenger during his time as a manager with Arsenal, having got to know him a lot and worked with him, especially through that first half of his time at Arsenal. So to see the man and what he did, I was always keen on the idea of a documentary. I'd known Christian Jean-Pierre, my co-director, for some time, a French broadcaster who worked with Arsene in the summers at TF1. So Arsene would do his summers with Arsenal and then summer, as he does at a FIFA World Cup or a Euros, commentating and working, such as his addiction to football. And about 18 months ago, Christian said, listen, I think finally, because we talked about the possibility of a documentary, Arsene might be willing to do one. And on we went. And Arsene, with some time and with some distance from Arsenal, hopefully has given us a portrait, helped us make a portrait that says definitive about him and his time at Arsenal, as we've seen. And that was the attraction, if you like, of the project. It was to be the first to do a film documentary with him.
How receptive was he to the idea of doing it? Because, you know, it's very difficult. I mean, it's a really great film, but it's quite difficult to be definitive in 90 minutes, 2 hours of a 20-year career. So you've obviously focused on the Invincible side of things, and that, I think, is probably his greatest achievement as a manager. I mean, how open was he to discussing that? I mean, I'm sure he was very open to it, but in the context of that, because I suppose when you are somewhere for 20 odd years, 22 years, as he was, there's a lot more going on. And obviously we'll come to that in this conversation. There was a lot to his time at Arsenal, but framing it around that particular season, was that something he was very open to?
Yeah. I mean, I think, listen, as he says in the film, that's his greatest moment. He achieved his lifelong dream. And without a shadow of a doubt, it's one of the greatest moments that English football's ever seen, yet to be matched in a sense by a team from the modern era. So, he was open to that, but he also knew that in the course of the filming that we would be discussing his career and certain choices, life choices, what motivated him, take him back to Duttlenheim where it all began to get a sense of the person, you know, underneath things, which I don't always think you've been able to get. I think there have been a lot of impressions of Arsene Wenger over time. I think that naturally comes, especially when you spend so long at one club. You get into a routine. You aren't maybe as three-dimensional. Was peel back some of the layers. It's an overused phrase. Hmm. But that was our challenge and what we had to do to get a sense of the person and the how he was made, what made him, the compromises he made, the choices he made, and how he reflected on not only his achievements, but also the things that went wrong. And the incredible story, the incredible thing about his time at Arsenal is that it is divided into these two very strict halves. He says it himself. And you have and therefore you're going to have a real emotional extremes across that period. And we wanted to enter and try and capture some of the reasons behind that emotional spectrum.
Was there anything about him during the period of making the documentary that surprised you? Like you talked about the three-dimensional aspect of someone like Arsene Wenger, who's been in the media, in the football landscape for so many years. You know, Arsenal fans knew him inside out and back to front. But after a while, like you say, somebody or something can become part of the furniture in a way. I mean, were there things that you thought about him that weren't true or anything, misconceptions about his character? Because you talk about growing up in the Alsace just after the war. He talks about his father, as he did in the book, where his father never said well done to him. It was always, you can do better. That represents or suggests a certain hardness, doesn't it, to his own character? And he was looking for that approval, but always at the same time trying to get that approval by doing better and doing better.
Absolutely. I think that certainly did interest me, the nature of his family background. I think that was fascinating, and it's something we put to Sir Alex Ferguson that Sir Alex was able to relate to. I think that this hard working class background in rural France, you imagine rural France to be maybe more middle class. At least maybe I might have made that mistake, but Dullenheim hasn't changed. It's a working class area where work is work and working is valued, and religion is still powerful. And this was a special environment in which Arsene was made. And so to put that across and come back to Dullenheim as we do throughout the film, I think was very important to break up the narrative between personal football and a sort of broader spectrum of things was really important to us. And hopefully that helps you get a sense of the person and what made him special, what drove him on, the insecurities maybe that he might have had, which I don't think I was necessarily that aware of before making the film. I hope that people, when they watch this film, not only, you know, you don't get the sense of a film that's just being nice to Arsene and is whitewashing things, because you can't do that with this story. It's not straightforward. And I hope also people are able to get a truer sense of the man himself with what he's been able to tell us and show us during the film. That had to be the target.
Is that a difficult thing to do as a filmmaker when you are dealing with somebody, you know, quite directly as part of the making of the film? You want to tell their story, but you want to present both parts of it. And I think we all have maybe aspects of our life, if there was a film being made about it, look, focus on this stuff and not so much on that stuff. Yeah. I mean, I get the, you know, it must be a little bit difficult.
That is the dilemma always. And especially, you know, I've done documentaries about, Bobby Robson wasn't with us when I made that documentary. Documentaries about figures who aren't alive. So the challenge when you're doing a documentary with a figure who is alive and is obviously contributing, the great thing is that they'll say something, you know, you aim to get something new from them. The other side of that, of course, is that, they may be more defensive and less open to discussing certain things. And the challenge, of course, the simple challenge with this film as well, was we made it during COVID. Really, it was a film that was done throughout that period. So we had limited windows with Arsene. We wanted to film with him in France. We wanted to film with him in London. And you have to maximize that time. And as you know, he's a very busy man. Mm. So on a basic level, it was making every second count. And that also includes, listen, Arsene, there are areas we want to cover in the interviews, and we're going to go there. And Arsene has always been accepting of that. The challenge is, of course, then to, as I say, to peel back the layer a bit more and to encourage him to go into areas, especially in relation to Arsenal, that he's not gone into before. And I think with some distance, assistance that he's had since he left the club that hopefully has benefited the film.
Mm. You talk about showing both sides of things and his career having these two distinct halves. I think what an interesting aspect of this was, there was a part of the film near the beginning where I was looking at it going, I think I need to turn this off because it's too soon for me. And there are elements in the early parts of Arsene Wenger's career where there were defeats, and I'm thinking around that 1999 FA Cup semi-final with Manchester United, which I've not looked back on in the past because I remember it so distinctly. I remember how it made me feel. There was this perception that the first years of Arsene Wenger's career at Arsenal were success all the way, and I'm not sure that's necessarily true. There were huge successes and huge triumphs and huge achievements, but also fairly crushing blows as well. I do think that's an interesting aspect of this because it does inform perhaps the way that the motivation and the desire to do what he did with the Invincibles, to go through a season unbeaten, was perhaps in some ways informed by United's treble. Because that even if Arsenal did it, it wouldn't be a unique achievement. Whereas this was and remains a unique thing.
Yeah, I think that's very important. By the time you get to there were obviously key games which we wanted to focus on throughout that 1998-2004 period, building to the Invincible season, and you had that, obviously, the double success and then the sense that everything was going perfectly. Arsenal were heading for another double until that night at Villa Park, the gigs got. And this sense, I think, that there were, from a storytelling point of view and a dramatization point of view, there are key moments. You have that penalty with Bergkamp. You have the Giggs goal, you have the Van Nistelrooy, you have the Vieira sending off, you have the Van Nistelrooy penalty in 2003. Then you have the Henry game when things are flipped in 2004 and they finally shake off this idea that they're chokers. Because there was a feeling that Arsenal would always, I think, not quite manage to get over the line after 99. So in the bigger picture of things. So we had these wonderful pillars in terms of the game and narratives, and that's why we wanted to shoot scenes with Arsene reliving those games. So that was structured quite clearly. I do think in relation to Manchester United, one isn't as successful without the other. Well, we needed Sir Alex Ferguson in the film to reflect that. But do Manchester United win the treble if Arsenal aren't there to push them? I'm not so sure. If Arsenal hadn't arrived the season before and set a new standard with the double, and then after Manchester United win the treble, Arsenal don't go on to be invincible if United haven't set that standard, because Arsenal knew that they had to, and Arsene knew he had to develop a physicality and a mental strength to his team to match Manchester United and then overcome them. And that was proven in the Battle of Old Trafford, that Arsenal were measuring up and actually stronger than United by that point. And that physicality and that mentality aspect of it is fascinating, because that's not necessarily associated with Arsenal teams and Arsene's Arsenal teams. But without a shadow of a doubt, that was, I think, their greatest quality in that 2003-04 season.
It's curious to say that, isn't it? Because there was always an edge to Arsenal. There were always the stories about the red cards and Wenger shame as Arsenal, maybe they were picked on a bit because there was a perception of them as a foreign team. And I think it's Ian Wright who says, the start where you do the setup, where there was that issue on the Highbury steps where he had to confront the press. And Ian Wright said something along the lines of, they were afraid of him because he was a foreign manager. He was alien. He was doing things that people weren't used to doing and they didn't expect or didn't want from a foreign manager. But going back to Alex Ferguson, he is basically the only non-Arsenal talking head in the film, if you like. You've got some great cameos in there from brilliant Arsenal players of that era who have lots of great things to say. But for Sir Alex Ferguson to be part of it as well, I think is... That rivalry between those two teams and between those two managers, it was so intense. as fans, for them, for players. That comes across in the film. You can watch any footage on YouTube. You can see how simmering it is. And I remember living it at the time and it being absolutely brilliant. And I'm not sure that we'll ever see anything like that again because we don't have this two-team era. So how was it to talk to Alex Ferguson about that down the line, given that there has been over the years a thawing between them and perhaps between even the two sets of fan bases who can look back on that period and think, wow, that was just kind of once in a lifetime experience for us?
It was very important that Sir Alex contributed. He knew that this is the first film and the last film documentary, I think, that Arsene will make about himself. And so that, I think, was one reason why he felt he should contribute. I think also, as you say, there's a growing respect between the two. Some might say that Sir Alex has grown, his respect has grown and grew because over the second half of Arsene's reign, Arsene wasn't such a threat. But without a shadow of a doubt, as Sir Alex says in the film, what Arsene achieved in particular in that 2003-04 season is something special. And as you know, if you watch the film, Sir Alex says something, well, which shocked me about that achievement and was wonderful to hear. But I just think that, you know, and Sir Alex was really interesting on Arsene's roots. When we talked to him about Dutlenheim and the working class background, and the work ethic and value system that Arsene grew up with, immediately Sir Alex was able to relate to that from Govan and from the shipyards and the impoverished background that he came from, yet the incredible value system that his family gave him. So I think that both as leaders were remarkable men, and Sir Alex has huge admiration for Arsene as a leader and what he was able to do over that length of time. He says, I think we were like two dinosaurs. You'll never see it again. Managers going for that length of time at their clubs. So in that sense, they are special, very, very special figures and can relate to each other. And that's why I think Sir Alex was wanted to contribute to the film because of those things that they have in common.
The sense of place, you talk about Dutlenheim, and Arsene Wenger talks about Highbury as a really special place. There's a moment in the film where he says he still just walks down the hill towards the stadium to relive whatever it is that he wants to relive, I guess, and to see those sights, you know, away from the match day crowd. And for Arsenal fans, Highbury is obviously a very, very special place. But without wanting to fast forward too close to the end and without wanting to give anything away, I mean, there's no huge spoilers here, but there is a real sense of regret. It comes across from Arsene about how things ended, about the fact that they ended. I get the sense that the way they ended is something that still, I won't say troubles him, but it's still very much to the forefront of his mind. And he hasn't been back to the Emirates since he left. So what was that aspect of it like when you were talking with him? I mean, there are a couple of things that he says towards the end which are really quite poignant. I don't know if what he says about returning is a kind of defense mechanism, but you do get the sense that there's something missing, you know?
I think, you know, what is in the film is what he said. We haven't left anything out in that sense. And I think Arsene's self-critical. He's able to be more self-critical now about things that happened in the Emirates era, and especially towards the end of the Emirates era. We pressed him on that because we had to do that. And I think it, you know, obviously Arsenal fans are divided on the way things happened. The players, the A-list players that we interview in the film are divided on the way that it ended for Arsene. It's just not straightforward. Life isn't sweet, Thierry Henry says it. Sir Alex Ferguson's farewell, the way that he managed it, that's a rare thing. That is rare. It's such a shame, and maybe it's beholden upon both Arsenal and Arsene that they didn't manage the exit better, but maybe they tried as best they could and they just couldn't work it out. So therefore, there is going to be that sense of regret and confusion and difficulty. And what we tried to do in the film was simply illustrate it. What we had was really strong footage, which hasn't been seen before, of Arsene on his final day at the Emirates, in the tunnel, waiting and being filmed as he waited to be given this guard of honour as he said goodbye. I think so many people wanted that day to be a day to celebrate. They wanted that day to be a wonderful goodbye where everything's great and it all sounds and feels wonderful. But it wasn't like that. And the people concerned didn't feel that way, especially Arsene. But others like Patrick Vieira, Robert Pires, they didn't feel that way. So it was uncomfortable. And I think it remains uncomfortable. Mm. And that is just the nature of the situation that both Arsenal and Arsene got themselves into. It's life, isn't it? Things aren't always easy.
Yeah, I was there that day and I remember his speech. I remember the reception he got from the crowd. I remember the overwhelming sense of gratitude and people wanted for him to get a good goodbye.
But what you won't have seen is the shots in the tunnel of him waiting for this and dreading it and not wanting to be there.
Mm.
He says it was like a funeral. He's not going to come out on the pitch and say that, but that is the way he felt about it. And that in terms of the documentary, that is obviously something that we had to put across, and we frame it at either end of the film. And I think as a non-Arsenal supporter, as somebody who wants to make a film that's going to appeal not just to Arsenal fans, but beyond that, I think that's fascinating material because it's life, it's documentary, it's the truth, it's just it's Shakespearean in the sense that he is the sort of King Lear figure without trying to be too pretentious about it. Who's has he lost touch with reality? You know, should he have gone earlier? It's just the way that life is, and life repeats itself. The mistakes repeat themselves, and that sometimes the greatest men, the most intelligent men and women, can't see beyond themselves.
Yeah,
that's the way it is.
Yeah, look, it's easy sometimes to look back with hindsight and say, I should have done this, I should have done that. He said, I think there's a line in the film where he says, one week you're facing a load of criticism, the next everybody wants to be nice to you. And that, I think, even if he understood the reasons behind both the criticism and the desire to be nice, I guess it's a difficult thing to try and contend with.
To try and balance as a person, in your life. Yeah. It was based around love. It was based around all the right motives. I believe that. From Arsene. It was based around wanting to do the right thing. But of course, when does wanting to do the right thing then swing over into selfishness, into ego, into pride? And it's a fascinating element of his story. And I think the way that he talks about it now with distance for the first time, front on to camera, is one of the things that I think everyone who loves, who's aware of the Arsene story and likes a good football story will want to see.
No, I agree. And there's some fascinating stuff behind the scenes, not just, on that, but throughout his Arsenal career. And I think the fact that maybe he has been confronted with a couple of things. With the book, for example, it felt like it could have used somebody to sort of steer him in the right direction in certain ways. And, in the context of the film, that's something you guys have done fantastically well. So, look, thank you very much indeed for making it. Thank you for your time and good luck with the film. We'll add all the links and trailers and all the information for people so they can find out where it's on and how they can get it. But Gabriel Clark, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much indeed to Gabriel Clark. The film is called Arsene Wenger Invincible. It is in cinemas from the 11th of November. It's out on Blu-ray, DVD and digital download from the 22nd of November. And if you haven't already seen the trailer, you will find a link to it in the show notes. So just click away there on your favorite podcasting app. That will open up the trailer for you and you can have a look. I was lucky enough to see the film in advance of the interview. And I have to say, I really, really enjoyed it. Bittersweet at times, it's fair to say, but that's kind of how it was and how it ended up. I'm sure that you guys will enjoy that when you do get a chance to see it.
Thank you all for being such an important part of my life and hope to see you soon. Well done. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Okay, before we crack on with the next part of the show, I just want to give you a heads up that Arsblog has been nominated for Best Fan Media at the FSA Awards, the Football Supporters Association Awards. We are defending our title as Best Fan Media, or Best Fran Merida, if you like. We're up against some very stiff and high-quality opposition, so if you could take the time to vote for us, we would really, 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 really appreciate it. You will find a link to the voting form in the show notes right now, or you can find it on arsblog.com on the post for this particular podcast episode. You'll find it there. Please give us your vote for Best Fan Media. It would be great to defend our title. Another trophy for Arsenal would be fantastic. There are also some Arsenal options in there when it comes to Women's Player of the Year, including Kim Little and Vivian Miedema. Alex Scott is up for Pundit of the Year, and Susie Rack is also up for Writer of the Year. So if you want to keep it red and white, keep those votes coming. And we thank you very, very, very much in advance for doing that. I think the votes are open for another couple of weeks, so we will give you some more periodic reminders on this in the days and weeks to come. Right, time to get on with the show. And joining me to talk Arsenal, to talk about bits and pieces that are on in the world of football, and to talk about the Scouted Football Handbook, it is Phil Costa. Hello.
Hey, Andrew, how's it going?
It's going okay. I want to start by asking you what you've made of goings on down the road. I know this is an Arsenal podcast, but when stuff happens there, we kind of have to reference it, pay attention a little bit. We're in familiar territory where they're appointing a manager that everybody thinks is going to be a huge success. And clearly, Antonio Conte is a very successful coach, a very good coach, who may well do a good job there. But, you know, this is a club which announced their new Italian manager in Spanish. So there are fundamental issues for him to deal with.
Oh, man, that was unbelievably cringy when I saw that. Imagine the sheer panic of the social media intern. Like, he must have turned white when they saw it. Like, oh, my God, I'm done already. But, you know, that's just them, isn't it? Nice to know that it carries itself around the club and not just on the pitch. So,
yeah,
we like a bit of Spursiness. And, yeah, I mean, the thing that annoyed me about Conte was, you know, I know they tried for him in the summer and obviously he said no because he just left Inter and won the Scudetto. But it kind of feels like to me that they've stumbled upon this opportunity through their own incompetence. Because let's be honest, he shouldn't be anywhere near Tottenham, Antonio Conte. This is like one of the top five coaches in the world, and they've managed to snag him because the timing hasn't been right for anybody else, and they've just sacked their what was it, 10th choice manager who was never going to work from the summer. So it was just a bit like, as if they've managed to do one of their most terribly thought out, you know, managerial appointments. Well, since I don't know when, since the last few years, and they've just managed to stumble across Antonio Conte. I'm sure it's from their, you know, the links with Fabio Paratici in their sort of director's box now. But
yeah,
you know, let's see. I mean, it's obviously you'd prefer him not to be there, but at the end of the day, it's the history of the Tottenham. So we have to see what happens, and hopefully that continues.
For sure. I did like the reports that said Antonio Conte reveals that Daniel Levy's contagious enthusiasm and determination were key to him taking the role, and not the £13 million a season that was on offer to him. You know, because like you say, he shouldn't be anywhere near a club like that. So look.
No, not at all.
We can only hope it goes the way that it always goes and always has gone and probably always will go. If there's consistent things in the world, the sun sets, the sun rises, and Spurs will always find a way to be Spursy, you know? So let's keep fingers crossed.
Amen. Amen. Yeah.
A prayer to get this going. Right. I want to talk to you about a couple of Arsenal things, and there's been a lot of praise for players in this recent run of form. Aaron Ramsdale, look, we don't need to do that. It's been done to death already. The back four in particular, a lot of the new faces in that back four. But one in particular, Gabriel, has really stood out for me. It's his second season, so he's not necessarily the new face, but he has in the, whatever it is, seven Premier League games that he's played, really, really come to the fore as a key part of what is a new defensive unit.
Absolutely. You know, I've always been kind of pro Gabriel, because what I saw in him, you know, even though he was young and still very raw, we could see that, you know, this was kind of the mold of a potentially elite centre back here, but especially in English football. Tall, strong, you know, he likes the contact, he likes to be in those battles, he's always ready to put his head and his body where it hurts. And I thought, okay, you know, we've got something here. And he's obviously started off so well, and then for a variety of reasons, you know, with COVID and just the natural sort of dip in form as he acclimatized, you know, people forget that it's not just, you know, going to training every day and playing to change your life, you're changing your language, changing your, you know, your everything, your routine. And I think that's very difficult for young people. You know, we can't forget that these are very young people, you know, essentially moving their whole lives with a lot of pressure. And for me, it was that whole sort of stage where Pablo Mari was coming into the side, and everyone was, you know, oh, maybe Pablo Mari is better than Gabriel. And I was just shaking my head like, this is absolute nonsense. I mean, look, he's been fine, Pablo Mari, but I just saw, I'm not going to say it was the general consensus, but it was definitely a noise for a long while. And I just wasn't having any of it, because I think in the present, Gabriel looks a million times better. In the future, he's going to be a million times better. And I just think in terms of their suitability for English football, there was no competition really. And I just thought in the back of my head, give him some time and he'll be there. And now I'm sort of bearing the fruits of my labor, should we say. So very happy to be smug about that now.
Sure. Why not? Why not? I mean, things in football, you can be right for as long as you're right until you're wrong. So you might as well make the most of it.
Well, we don't need to mention that part. So.
Listen, one of the things before we delve into him a little bit was David Luiz was often talked about as a leader and, you know, a very senior figure and a popular figure, et cetera, et cetera. But I do wonder, if you are a young Brazilian player, if it's difficult to sort of operate in his shadow in a way, if that in some ways has played a part in Gabriel maybe feeling a bit more confident about being that leader, being that dominant personality in the back four, which you can't be if David Luiz is there. It's just not possible. He's just too big a force of nature. I'm not saying it's always a good force of nature. Sometimes it's a lovely sunny day. Other times it's a hurricane which destroys everything in its path. But it's there, you know? And Luiz is not there anymore. And I think that might be part of why we're seeing him take a little step forward in that regard.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it can also work both ways, because I felt like if you needed someone to kind of hold his hand a bit, David Luiz was essentially the prime candidate, you know, experienced, obviously can speak the language, same nation. He could have been a really influential figure in his first kind of season there. So in that kind of sense, you know, I even though there are arguments to say that David Luiz could have been maybe a bit overbearing, I think in terms of him settling, that was a kind of nice thing to have. Mm. But in terms of his sort of sporting development at the club, I think we can see now that he's ready to take on that role of, you know, the rock at the back there, basically. You know, he's always ready to be commanding. You know, you can see him G'ing up the guys, you know, getting them up, getting the defensive line up. He's always pointing and screaming now. And I think it's been really nice to see that come out of him. And actually, I saw the Unclassic commentary today with Cedric. I don't know if you managed to catch it. I
had a chance to see it.
They did the game that we won against Spurs last season, the 2-1 at home. And he's a big character. I mean, you can see him there with Cedric and he's laughing, joking, and, you know, like the classic Brazilian commentators do when they just scream goal for about 50 hours and, you know, having a good laugh there in Cedric and with his native language, you know. And I just think the language must have been a big, you know, Mikel Arteta's already mentioned it, Ramsdale mentioned it, and I think now that his English is slowly, we're seeing the best of Gabriel, not only sort of leadership sense as well. And I think that can only be a positive for the club.
I was looking back at the profile you wrote of him when he signed last year. And one of the things that stood out for me, because you touch on the players when you do these things, you do like some strengths and some weaknesses. And one of the things that you said was that maybe because of the way that he plays, being very reliant on his stronger side, his left-hand side, is that he's often targeted or was targeted for a high press. And I think it's quite interesting, you know, two things. One, we haven't really seen that. We haven't seen opposition press him. And I think it's quite interesting because in the absence of Granit Xhaka, in many of the games, he is now the guy who has the most passes, the most touches, the most passes. He has become kind of like the fulcrum in that area of the pitch. And he does appear to be, well, not that he's press resistant, they're not doing it to him. So there must be like an awareness that this is a guy who can cope with that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, he's improved sort of. When I used to watch him for that profile piece, for example, you know, I didn't feel like he'd grown into his body completely, and which is perfectly normal for a 21, 22-year-old guy. You're still kind of at the latter stages there of your growth. And I felt he just needed to put on a bit of size because he felt quite gangly to me. And that made him look quite clunky and clumsy on the ball. And I think teams, especially in the Champions League, they noticed that and they kind of went for him. You know, I'm not saying he was bad with the ball or anything, but his defensive partner was Jose Font, and he was kind of just like, get it, give it, don't want this ball anywhere near me. But Gabriel was quite keen to bring it out and distribute, and I think teams clocked onto that a bit. So, but completely, I think his distribution has improved, his comfortability on the ball has improved, and I've really enjoyed him just fizzing passes through the lines this year. I think we've missed, obviously, we kind of need Thomas Partey for that. But on the left side in particular, that was kind of Granit Xhaka's thing, right? He's the guy that's fizzing those passes in to Tierney or Emil Smith-Rowe when he's coming off the touchline. And there's been a few times this season where I've looked at Gabriel and I was like, bloody hell, he's just pinged that like 40 yards from the ground. Straight into feet, you know, always at the right weight to give them a chance to control it, but also get there on time. And, you know, I've just been really impressed. But I think it's been quite interesting because I found some stats. And during his final season at Lille, he used to attempt 14 high passes per game. Then in his first season with Arsenal, it dropped to 9. And then in his second season, it's dropped to 6. So you can see that it's basically, you know, more than halved the amount of high passes that he's going, because at Lille, they used to go long a lot to Victor Osimhen. He used to run the channels and to their wide men, who were kind of very quick and direct. But I think now it's also in a slower team who maybe prefer the ball a bit. But also, I just think he's so much more comfortable and willing to trust his technique. And you can really see it when he strides out. I don't really feel like he takes the easy option either. You know, it's not just going left to Tierney every time. He's really fizzing them in. And I think it's been such a huge bonus and a surprise, really. Because I'm not sure many would have expected this, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I like as well about him is the desire to really become part of it, to become part of that mm-hmm. defensive unit, to be a dominant figure, an aggressive figure. We have been a team which has been a little bit easy to push around at times, and we have lacked some physical presence. And I think when you look at the partnership between himself and Ben White, everyone thinks like £50 million, you're going to bring in a centre half and this guy's going to be the boss, you know? And it's not the case with Ben White. He's got a different way of playing the game. He's a different kind of character. He seems, you know, not like a shrinking violet or anything like that, because he left a couple on James Maddison, one of which led mm-hmm. to the free kick, which Aaron Ramsdale saved. So, you know, it's not that he's not physical, but he's never going to be that kind of big, dominant physical presence. And I think the confidence that he's got now with his language, having settled in and everything else, I just think this is a guy who really is ready to take a big step forward.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's what you said about why, you know, there were maybe those preconceptions made that he was going to come in. But he was never really like that, even at Leeds and at Brighton. He was kind of the guy who went about his business very quietly. I mean, as you said, it didn't mean he was weak. It just meant that he was kind of that guy who did his job, and that's how he does it. But you really feel like Gabriel likes, you know, to bang his chest when he makes a tackle and relish that contact, that battle with the striker, you know. I mean, we've seen it with Harry Kane. How many times now has Kane got nothing from Gabriel? Mm. You know, he's always climbing on top of him. And, you know, I just love that kind of spirit in a defender. And I think, you know, the best thing about this is we can just say that he was, you know, 50 million and that Pepe was a bit less. So we can kind of justify it in our heads like that. So, you know, forget the 72 million we paid for Pepe. You know, we've only paid 22 and we've paid 50 for Gabriel. So thanks very much, Lille. That's a lovely bit of business we've done there. So
put the two of them together and just split the difference and make both deals look
who
really
needs,
good.
You know, who needs record signings? Yeah, no, sure. No worries.
I want to ask you about...
Yeah, really...
Go on.
Yeah, super happy with him. And I think we found the gem. We found the gem, and I'm hoping it continues.
Right. I want to ask you about the system and the formation that we've been playing in the last little while. And again, people might say it's a manager stumbling onto something. I'm not necessarily sure that's quite fair, but it is a little bit different. Alexandre Lacazette came into the team and is performing quite a specific role, connection with Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, if it's a 4-4-2, 4-1-1, whatever it might be. I'm just curious as to your thoughts on the sort of Lacazette inclusion of late. Do you think that's a reward for the way that he just played against Villa? Do you think it's about getting another goal scorer on the pitch? Is it a way of maybe demonstrating to people that even though they haven't got much time left on their contract, you know, they can still be used, that there's a sort of egalitarianism to the squad or whatever it might be? Because Lacazette's inclusion is coming at the exclusion of Martin Odegaard, who hasn't played well in the last few games, but is a big signing and one for the future. So how do you see the way Arteta is using Lacazette in these last few games?
I think it's definitely interesting. But in my kind of head, it can be boiled down to something very simple. And that's, as you mentioned, Odegaard wasn't playing well. Lacazette came in and did play well. And that's it. You know, he's kept his place in the team. Odegaard had a bit of a knock. And now it's up to him to get back into the team, basically. So, and I think look, although we've spent a lot of money on Martin Odegaard and we've all got very high hopes for him, you know, there's nothing wrong with changing your system or your tactics throughout the season, on, you know, if it's working. You know, and I think we found a nice sweet spot here with Lacazette, maybe with a point to prove, and we know he likes to work hard and kind of be a bit of a focal point, and that's always been a nice balance with Aubameyang. I mean, we've seen that with Emery. You know, they basically carried us to the Europa League final when they were in that kind of partnership up front. So, you know, I don't really have any issues with Martin Odegaard being pulled out of the side. I think, as you said, maybe it's just an example that if you're playing well and you're working hard, you can be in the team. But I think we've kind of struck a nice balance in that Lacazette can play maybe 55, 60 minutes at full throttle and then he's done. And maybe Arteta's just saying to him, look, go and be a bit secure for us in that centre. Go and put yourself about. Go and hit a few defenders. Take a few hits. Because at the moment it's working. He's playing well. Obviously, he adds another goal threat. And then if we need Odegaard to come on and replace him, and we need a bit more finesse, bit more composure on the ball, then we can do it. You know, I don't feel there's a huge issue. I think people have been complaining about Odegaard already. And it's just like, we have a squad for this reason, you know? And people complained last year that we didn't really try to vary things up a bit. And now we are, and they're still complaining. So it's just a bit like, well, you know, it's the same with Tavares now. And everyone's like, whoa, is Tierney going to lose his place? And it's like, well, Tavares is playing well. Who cares? You know, Tierney gets a rest. Tavares is playing. That's what we bought him for, you know? And it's just, I don't know. I like it. It's good. It's been a long time since we had this kind of option at Arsenal. So I'm completely happy with it. Really happy.
Do you see there being a fundamental change to the system if, for example, Odegaard starts ahead of Lacazette? Because Lacazette's a striker who's going to drop off a bit, be a bit more physically robust, stick his backside into people, maybe create or have a bit more threat around the penalty area than Odegaard would, who would sit deep and maybe look to create from deep. So are there potential knock-on effects for Smith Rowe or Saka, either side of him, if he plays rather than Lacazette in this particular system? Because we haven't necessarily seen this a huge amount with Martin Odegaard.
I mean, potentially. I mean, they're two different players, so there will naturally be a few stylistic differences when either one plays. But I think last season we saw perfectly fine that Smith Rowe can play on the left and with Martin Odegaard. You know, and the same for whoever's on the right, whether it's Bukayo Saka or Nicola Pepe. I think Odegaard has a nice tendency to drift over to that right side. So, you know, I think at the moment, Lacazette's in the team performing a very specific role, as you said, kind of physical, taking some of the heat away from Aubameyang, which has also seen him, you know, put in some hard yards as well. And he's been pressing and he's been battling as well. So it's been really good. I mean, sometimes you need someone to fall out of the side to give you something else. And that's what's happened. You know, I think Sambi coming closer to Partey has also made a big difference, I will say, because I could understand why in the first couple of games Arteta tried to do that whole Xhaka thing where he fills into the left-back position. But I just think now we have such a stronger presence in the middle with Lacazette, Partey, Sambi there. They're all, you know, they can all get stuck in. They can all hold the ball. And I think if Martin Odegaard were to come back in, for example, the role would be slightly different. But I just think we're better placed for him to thrive. And obviously, that needs to be down to him as well. And I'm sure he knows that and Arteta knows that. But, you know, as long as Lacazette's playing well, I've got absolutely no issue with Odegaard sitting it out for now.
Healthy competition. I think that's what we're looking
absolutely.
For, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely.
If Arsenal were to beat Watford on Sunday, and I'm taking nothing for granted, I've been pleased and encouraged by our recent form, and I think everybody has been, but, you know, this is not our first rodeo when it comes to Arsenal. So, you know, we take everything, not with a pinch of salt, but we're realistic to know that you know, there are still going to be some inconsistencies. However, home game, going into an interlull, you're targeting 3 points. If we were to get them, it would make it 20 points from the last 24. I think it would leave us in a fairly healthy position in the table going into the interlull, depending on other results. But we'd be there or thereabouts in terms of the top six, and certainly within distance of the top four. So given that that's where we are now, is it realistic to expect this Arsenal team to maintain that kind of pace, or to at least hang on in that area of the table between now and the end of the season? Because surely that's what the standards should be. That's what we're expecting. That's what Mikel Arteta has said about where this club needs to be, where it needs to go, etc., etc. They've dragged themselves up from that dreadful start to the season and got themselves into a really, really healthy position. And I think deserve great credit for that. But it's then about making sure you do it on a consistent basis.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think we spoke in one of the transfer podcasts at the start of the season, and or was it the preview with Andrew Allen, maybe, that we said top six is realistically where we need to be this year. Anything less would have been a really bad underperformance again. And after the poor start we had, I know it was some difficult games. We had players out with COVID. You know, it was just kind of a perfect storm, really. But we needed this run, you know, even if they're not all wins, to stay unbeaten. I mean, I know there were a couple of issues in the Brighton game and the Palace game, but we needed to kind of put a run on eventually, you know, and we're doing that. And for me, the big issue was the performances. You know, sometimes you can play well and lose. Sometimes you can play badly and win. But for me, the biggest issue has been our performances under Mikel Arteta. I've just found them a little bit too rigid, too structured, you know, not making a lot of chances. So we're on Twitter the next day posting screenshots of Emil Smith-Rowe running through and why is he not passing to Pepe, you know, because we're making like two chances a game. So they really mean a lot. And I've just found us to be a bit more balanced and, you know, a bit more adventurous going forward. I don't think we're so reliant on those one or two chances anymore. I mean, we still play in bursts, and I think there is an issue there with maybe our conditioning or our ability to manage games. I'm not sure. I'm sure they're looking at it, you know, behind the scenes, but I've just found us to be a much more enjoyable watch. And it feels like the team are finally onto something, you know, whether Arteta's changed something behind the scenes, I'm not sure. But I just feel like this group now, they kind of know their roles. We've got a much more committed physical back five. Obviously with Ramsdale coming in as well, I think they've made a big difference. And I've seen improvement, you know, and that's all I wanted, really. And hopefully now we can translate that performance, you know, the improvement of performance into points. And I think we can do it. You know, I think if you look across the squad, you see that first 11 and you feel confident in what you're seeing, because this is a good team. And it's, you know, hasn't always been the case. But you look, you know, you look at Thomas Partey now, you look at Emil Smith-Rowe and Saka coming into their own. We've got a really good defence. I don't know. I just feel like we've turned the corner. And for me, it was a big worry. And they're, you know, they're fading quite quickly now, because I think something's clicked. I'm not sure what it is, when it happened, maybe that Spurs game. But I'm just, you know, feeling good. So hopefully we can play Watford on Sunday, I think it is. And in front of a nice crowd at the Emirates, and really try and finish before the inter lull on a good note. Because it would just be a really nice thing for everybody.
Yeah, it's sort of like filling up your beliefometer, you know, as we do week
slowly,
after week.
Slowly.
Just slowly, you can start to feel a bit more confident. And hopefully that will happen on Sunday against Watford. Right, before we go, just one of the projects that you're involved in is called Scouted Football. So just tell us a little bit about what that is and what you do there.
Well, I mean, we're a website that was primarily created to focus on players who are young and up and coming, you know, primarily under the age of 23. So we'd, you know, we'd do little scouting reports and profiles on them. And, you know, it started as a website, and now we've slowly branched out into magazines and handbooks. And now we create four editions every year. So it's every quarter, basically. Filled with profiles on 25 young talents across world football. And that's, you know, from Argentina to Zimbabwe, you know, and everybody in between. So we have a really, you know, great team of writers who watch these guys. And I mean, watch them. Like, there's hours of footage being put into these pieces and their profiles. And, you know, we've also put features inside now. And I think it's just, you know, crazy considering it's a team of five, really. And we've, you know, with full-time jobs and no experience, we've managed to create something really cool and impressive. So I'm really proud of what we do. And yeah, I try and slip as much Arsenal bias as I can into them as possible. So
speaking of which,
which hopefully brings us, you know, segue, nudge, nudge. Yeah.
Speaking of which, the latest issue is very, very Arsenal centric. So tell us what's in there that will be of interest to Arsenal fans.
Absolutely. I mean, well, the cover jumps out. It's a, it's an amazing piece of work by an artist called Kevin McGiven, and he's done all of our covers this year, and they've all been sensational. But this one of Smith Rowe, you know, they look like photos. Really, the amount of detail he puts into these things are incredible. So, it's got a really nice cover of Emil Smith Rowe, and then I've written the profile, the corresponding profile inside of the magazine. And there's also a big feature on Hale End, written by Lewis Ambrose, who obviously many will know from the preview pods and some other Arscasts. And, you know, it's just a really cool piece of work with nice artwork, and, you know, it's really well put together. And, you know, there's also other bits about how Barcelona can rejuvenate through their academy. And we touched on the Chelsea Academy exodus. And there's also an interview from me from Victor Orta, the director of football at Leeds. And there's some really interesting stuff about recruitment and data analytics in there. And I think it's just, you know, a really cool thing to be involved in. And I think a lot of football fans, you know, even if you're not so interested on the youth angle, you can find, you know, sort of joy in those features. And, and yeah, with the Arsenal angle, we're happy to get it onto the pod.
All right. Well, look, we've got a couple of copies to give away to people of the handbook to give away, which we will do after this conversation. And we will put all the respective links in the show notes as well, so people can find it, follow the Twitter account and have a look at the website. Best of luck with it, Phil. And as always, thanks a million for your time.
Perfect. Thanks so much. Thanks for having me. And yeah, let's get a nice 3 points this weekend.
Let's do it. Thank you very much indeed to Phil. You can find him on Twitter. He is @_PhilCosta, @_PhilCosta. And the website, Scouted Football, is scoutedftbl.com. That's scoutedftbl.com. You'll find a link in the show notes. As I said, if you would like to win one of the magazines, we've got three to give away. It's got Emil Smith Rowe on the cover. In order to do that, here's what you do. Send an email to competition@arsblog.com. That is competition@arsblog.com. Tell me, what is the text in white on red on the Scouted Football website? When you visit scoutedftbl.com, what are the two words in white in a red box at the very top of the website? Simple as that. Competition@arsblog.com. Competition@arsblog.com. And we will announce the winners on next week's show. And with that, we will call time on this week's Arscast. Thank you, as always, for being here. For more on the Watford game on Sunday, join myself and Lewis Ambrose for a preview podcast exclusively on Patreon, patreon.com/arsblog. Mikel Arteta is meeting the press on Friday morning, so we'll get team news updates and all the bits and pieces. So we will have plenty to discuss ahead of that game at the Emirates on Sunday. Some decisions to be made regarding fitness over certain players, etc., etc. You'll also find on Patreon a brand new edition of the Poorly Drawn Month, in which myself and Poorly Drawn Arsenal, whose work I'm sure you know on Twitter and Instagram, I do the words, he does the artwork, we do a recap of the month. The latest one, which is on October, is out now, featuring some fantastic artwork. That is available for you as well, right over there, patreon.com/arsblog. Okay, James and I will be here on Monday, as always, with a brand new Arscast extra for you. For now, though, thank you for listening, for downloading, for subscribing, for sharing, for twirling. Nobody ever thinks to thank the people who twirl. not me. Thank you, twirlers. We will catch you on the next one. Until then, take it easy. Cheers. Bye-bye.
So, Antonio, welcome to your first interview with Spurs TV. Or should I say, bienvenido?
Sorry, correction. Bienvenido is actually Spanish.
Oh, silly me, of course, Antonio. Willkommen.
No, that's German.
Antonio, bienvenue to Spurs.
That's French.
Oh, so sorry, Antonio Conte. Cade me la fortune to Spurs.
That's Irish. How the fuck do you know Irish?
Mr. Conte, saluto to Tottenham.
Latin. Look, this is getting embarrassing. Just try something else.
It's me, Mario. Mamma mia. Okie dokie. Here we go. Let's go. Ah, spaghetti. Game over.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.